So my name is Eric Dehr. I'm a PhD student at CISPA, and today I'm going to present joint work on demystifying the Android application framework. So the first question that comes in mind is, why do we need to demystify the Android application framework? And the answer is, it's because the framework internals are still largely a black box for us. And as a consequence, we do not know how these internals influence both platform security and user privacy. And even worse, we do not have a comprehensive methodology on how to analyze the framework in the first place. And this would require to have a solid understanding of any platform-specific peculiarities that would impede such a static analysis. And if we have a look to static Android application analysis, we see that over the last years, there has been a dedicated line of work that establishes such a knowledge for Android applications. This includes approaches to enumerate all the application entry points. Moreover, there are approaches to generate a static runtime model that approximate complex application lifecycle behavior. And finally, there are techniques to automatically compile lists of sensitive sources and sinks that can be used to either access sensitive data, like the device identifier, or to send data off the phone. And if we get back to the platform security, we have a rough understanding of how the framework works. So it's composed of system services to provide core functionality to the application layer. But yet, such a knowledge base as we have it for application analysis is yet missing. And even worse, we cannot transfer or easily transfer this existing knowledge from applications to the framework because the framework is inherently different. And this brings me to our first contribution. So in the following, I will show you a systematic methodology on how to statically analyze the application framework. And this includes the enumeration of framework entry points as well as the generation of a precise static runtime model. And having such a methodology, we can then conduct any further security-related analysis on top. I then show that with such a methodology, we can improve on prior results by generating permission mappings for SDK and for the framework that improve on prior results. And finally, we dig a bit deeper into Android's permission system and answer the question or give a technique on how to classify sensitive operations that are guarded by Android's permission checks. And finally, we show where permissions are checked in the framework and answering the question, what security implications this might have. Okay, so let's start with the question on how to statically analyze the framework. Similar as for Android application analysis, there are three main challenges that you have to overcome. First is how to enumerate a framework entry points. Second, how to generate a static model that approximates the runtime behavior. And third, what are the sensitive operations within the framework API? Let's start with the framework entry points. So we want to know what functionality is exposed to the application layer. And the key observation is that inter-process communication in Android goes via the binder mechanism. And there is an interface class called iInterface, which is the base interface class for all binder communication. And by conducting a class hierarchy analysis, we can enumerate all the classes that expose functionality to the application layer. By doing this, we first retrieve a list of interface classes, which can be grouped to ADL and non-ADL interface classes, where ADL stands for Android Interface Definition Language. These are basically standard Java interfaces that come with an ADL compiler that automatically generates two classes, a proxy and a stub class, where the proxy is a low-level implementation of the interface, and the stub class is an abstract class that is extended by the actual service, like the audio service or location manager service. And for each Android version, there are a couple of non-ADL interfaces. These work basically similar with the exception that instead of having an auto-generated subclass, you have a native class which is extended by services like the Activity Manager service. And the reason is that such services can also be called from native code, and therefore some binder transaction codes need to be hard-coded. Once we have a full list of such classes, we can now easily extract all public methods to enumerate or to compile a list of framework entry points. After having such a list of entry points, the next step is how to build a static runtime model. So we know that framework services follow the principle of separation of duty. And they need to be highly responsive in order to process simultaneous requests from multiple applications. And to do so, they use various concurrency patterns that impede any kind of static analysis. So besides standard Java runnables, there exist three main concurrency patterns in the framework. The first and most prevalent one is the message-based handler class. So in a nutshell, you create a message stating the functionality that you want to execute. You send it to the handler, which then spawns a separate thread in which the functionality is executed. The second pattern is asynchronous channel, which is basically the same, but further allows bidirectional communication. And finally, we have hierarchical state machines, which further introduce states to allow managing more complex scenarios like Wi-Fi connections or Bluetooth connections. And while the handler pattern is also available for application developers, async channel and state machines are exclusive to the framework. And if you want to conduct a precise static analysis, you have to be able to accurately model such concurrency pattern. And at the example of the handler, will show you what typical challenges you have to face. So many servers have a dedicated handler to process messages in a separated thread. And an example code would look like this. So you have a reference to a handler, which is called mHandler, and the first thing you need to do is to obtain a message stating the message code for the functionality that you want to execute. And then you can send the message to the registered handler, which in this case is a simplified version of the Bluetooth handler. This handler overrides a handle message function, which receives the message, and typically includes a huge switch statement, which covers all the functionality that is exposed by the service. And now, what are the typical challenges? So first, you have to be able to infer the runtime type of the handler instance in order to know the recipient of the message. Second, you need to be able to infer the message code in order to know the functionality that is triggered. And most importantly, you have to be able to add path sensitivity to the switch construct such that you can infer a mapping of message code to the basic block that would have been executed at runtime. Because if you solely rely on a simple reachability analysis, you end up in enumerating all the service functionality, which could end in a lot of false positives. But if you add path sensitivity, you can accurately focus on the execution path that would have been executed at runtime, and therefore your approach would not suffer from a huge over-approximation. Okay, so now after we have seen how to enumerate the framework entry points and how to build a model, the next and last question is, how do we identify sensitive behavior within the framework? The problem is that the concept of sources and sinks, as we know it for application analysis, is no longer applicable here, because the analysis now shifts into the framework. So the question remains, how do we classify sensitive behavior? And a good start is to consider permission checks as guards to sensitive behavior. And to give an informal definition on what we mean by sensitive operations, we say that protected resources are security critical operations that have a tangible side effect either on the system state, for instance, if you change or add some network connection, or that have a side effect on the use of privacy, for instance, if you retrieve sensitive data. So now we have a rough understanding on what we are looking for, but we do not know exactly how such operations look like. And unfortunately, there's no ground truth so far. So the only thing which you can do is to sit down, have a coffee, and take a deeper look into the Android's applications framework code. And that's what we did. So we manually investigated 35 entry points of different services. And based on our expert knowledge, we could then compile a list of sensitive operations. And finally, we ended up in having a huge list of such operations, which are also tailored or specific to the API which we were analyzing. So this diversity of operations forced us to come up with some higher level classification, not on the operation, but on the operation type. And this finally led to the taxonomy of protected resource types. And the first protected resource that I want to introduce are method invocations. More particular, native method invocations as gateway to the device hardware. For instance, if you set some audio settings, or if you want to establish some near-field communication. The second type of resources are broadcast senders that have a side effect on the system. And this side effect strongly depends on the registered receivers, both in the application framework and on the installed applications on the device. The second type are field updates. And during our analysis, we found that this is the most prevalent type of resource types, with a share at about 70%. So whenever you want to change some configurations, this basically boils down to one or more field updates that can be classified as V-sensitive operations. Then we have return values. So whenever you have a non-void return value for your framework API, this return value includes more or less sensitive data, for instance, a list of network connections or some error code. And finally, we have throw runtime exceptions, which is the most surprising result in our taxonomy. And we found exactly one case during our manual investigation of throwing runtime exception. And we thought, cool, we found a corner case. But actually, if we applied the taxonomy to the entire code base, we found that by no means this is an outlier. Because across Android versions, we found more than 50 instances of throwing runtime exceptions in the Android source code. And the main reason for this is that Android uses a lot of third-party code, for instance, Bouncy Castle, JSIP, or XML pull parser. And most of these libraries throw a runtime exception whenever they get to an inconsistent state. And this leaves Android developers basically with two choices. So either they patch the library to not throw runtime exception, which comes with some additional maintenance effort, or they can just catch the runtime exception and try to recover and get to some consistent state again. And that's actually what the Android developers do. Okay, so now we have seen how to analyze the framework, and now we want to see at the use case of permission analysis if you can indeed improve on prior results. So we revisit Android permission mappings because Android permissions are still a major security mechanism. And they have proven to be a very important tool for app developers and security research for many years. And we compare our results with the state-of-the-art tool pSCOUT, which was proposed at CCS 12. And we compare our results with API 16, which were their latest results available at the time when we conducted our analysis. But before I show the actual results, I want to give you a primer on what are permission mappings. So the basic idea is to have a mapping between framework entry points and a list of required permissions. And we started with the framework entry points, and we conducted a control flow for slicing to eventually reach permission check function calls. And if we found some, we conducted an additional string analysis to infer the actually checked permission. This finally resulted in a mapping of framework entry points like get device identifier function of the phone interface manager that requires the dangerous permission read phone state. And here are the first results for the framework API mapping. So this graph shows the total number of API to permission mappings. And as you can see, there's a huge gap between our tool Explorer and the tool pSCOUT. And the results are even more surprising because pSCOUT only includes normal and dangerous permission, because at the time, they focus on permissions that could be requested by app developers. In contrast, we additionally include system and system or signature permissions because we wanted to have a complete list in this regard. But what are the root causes for this huge gap? So first of all, our results, the smaller number is in this case the more accurate number because we introduce less false positives. And the root cause for this reduced over-approximation is the additional effort that we spend in modeling the call graph. This does not only include strong type inference and resolving dynamic dispatch, this particularly also refers to the accurate modeling of all the concurrency pattern that I've presented before. So especially this huge switch statement for the handler class. Moreover, our entry point definition ensures that each mapping that our tool reports indeed starts with a valid entry point that can be called from the application layer. The next mapping is the SDK mapping, which is basically an extension to the framework mapping. So you add the SDK, which at some point uses inter-process communication to call a framework entry point. And finally, you receive a mapping of SDK entry points to a list of required permissions. And these are the first results that show the number of permissions required by SDK APIs. And here are two important things that you should note. First of all, the total number of mappings is now much closer than the number of mappings that we have seen before for the framework mapping. Second, our tool Explorer does not report outliers with more than three permissions. And the root causes are the following. So in the process of connecting the framework to the SDK, a lot of false mappings are automatically eliminated. Because if you do not have a framework mapping that starts with a valid framework entry point, you cannot connect it to the SDK. And therefore, a lot of non-API entry method mappings are automatically ruled out. And as for the outliers, adding this additional path sensitivity in the concurrency pattern, like in the handler, also eliminates a lot of false mappings. In particular, if you just rely on a simple reachability analysis, you end up in enumerating all the functionality in the handler class, which also implies that you sum all the permissions that are required by this functionality. While at the same time, if you are able to pinpoint the analysis to the exact execution branch, you also only consider the permission that is required for this execution branch. The second mapping shows the number of documented APIs that requires a specific permission, like NFC, set wallpaper, or Bluetooth. And here you can see that the results largely differ with respect to the permission. So for instance, for the NFC and Bluetooth permission, our tool reports less mappings, while at the same time for set wallpaper and broadcast sticky, we report more mappings. So what numbers are correct? Therefore, we manually validated all the mappings for the top four permissions to find the root cause. And surprisingly, the differences in the results were mainly due to the SDK analysis. So the different results that we have for the framework mapping did not influence this mapping at all. And at the example of the set wallpaper permission, I will show you why there are different mappings. So the analysis of the set wallpaper permission mainly refers to analyzing the context class, which is a core class for the application development. And this class is difficult to get right for static analysis because it includes more or it has more than 100 direct and indirect subclasses. And the context class defines an API to set the wallpaper. And because of that, all the direct and indirect subclasses which are non-abstract inherit those API as well. So you have to get your class hierarchy analysis right to report the correct numbers. And in the process of generating the permission maps, we found that some permissions were checked in more than one location. And we call this aspect permission locality. So we wanted to investigate this a bit deeper. So while the services follow the principle of separation of duty, we want to find out whether the respective permissions follow this principle as well. So we conducted an analysis on several Android versions and found that across API versions, roughly 20% of permissions are checked in more than one class, with exceptional cases that are checked in up to 10 classes. And this aspect equally affected all protection levels. So it did not matter whether it was a normal, a dangerous, or system permission. And we could show that there is a clear trend towards having more checks for a particular permission in more classes in newer Android versions. And we measured permission locality in terms of number of distinct classes in which a given permission was checked. And we referred to high permission locality if a permission was checked or enforced at a single location. An example for this would be the set wallpaper permission that was enforced only in the wallpaper manager service. In contrast, the low permission locality is a permission that is enforced in different, possibly unrelated services or classes. An example for this is the dangerous read phone state permission. So here you can see the four classes in Android API 16 in which this permission is checked. But those four classes reside in four different packages. And even worse, one of the class, not even part of the application framework, it's part of the telephony system app, which might or might not be included depending on the device vendor. And if we now check how the results change for a newer Android version, here we can see the results for Android API 22. And there are two main differences. So first, the phone subinfo class was renamed to phone subinfo proxy. And another class called subscription controller was added that included one or more checks to this permission. But what are the security implications for this? So we have seen that locality statically decreases in newer Android versions. This impedes the overall understanding of Android's permission system. Because whenever you want to know which components of the framework try to access a particular resource, you have to have a proper permission analysis. And the question is, would it make sense to have a single enforcement point for permissions? So if you have a look at access control frameworks like ASM or ASF that have been proposed in the last years, their security policy strongly depends on having knowledge about where permissions are checked in the framework. And the secure policy can suddenly become incomplete if a new Android version is published and new classes were added with permission checks for the same permission. Well, if you have a single enforcement point, your secure policy can remain secure because you only have one single enforcement point and only the callers to this enforcement point are changing. How could this be established? Well, for each permission, you could identify an owning class or an owning service, and then you could add a dedicated permission check method, which can then be exposed to the application layer, for instance, via ADL. Okay, so this concludes my talk. To briefly summarize our findings, we have presented a comprehensive and systematic methodology on how to statically analyze the application framework. And this methodology forms a knowledge base on which further security-related analysis can be easily built on top. We gave a first high-level classification of protected resource types, answering the question, what is actually protected by Android's permissions? Then we revisited permission analysis and showed that our new methodology indeed improved on prior results for SDK and framework permission mappings. Then we introduced a new aspect called permission locality to improve the overall understanding of Android's permission system. And finally, check out our project website, explorer.org, to find all the results and, of course, the new permission maps. With that, thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So while people are considering, so I'm curious in the paper you discuss that one of the things you don't deal with is intents, which is effectively a message system. Can you talk a little bit about why that is and what it would take to deal with frameworks that make use of intents?
So of course, intents and also permission mappings for content providers are quite important to have a complete framework mapping. But they are not conceptually different to what we've seen in the paper. And the main problem was how it is often the lack of time before the submission. And the time that we had, we wanted to spend on manually investigating all the results that we produced to really make sure that the results that we report are indeed correct. So if time permits, we will, of course, implement mappings for intents, content providers. And once we have the results, we will update our website accordingly.
Okay, and I want to thank you very much for actually making that effort to make the data available to the public. I think that is a standard that we should try to hold ourselves to as a community so that people can build directly off of the results. Any other questions from the audience? No, so with that, let's thank our speaker one last time.
Thank you.